Okay, I think we are more or less done. Also, Dan put his introduction. He's an assistant professor of practice at North Dakota State University College of Pharmacy. His role is instructional designer, and his dissertation used design-based research and tried to find ways to implement it where he is working now. So let me quickly introduce Dan Hickey. Dan Hickey is a professor of in the learning sciences program, also program coordinator of the learning sciences program at Indiana University at Bloomington. And many of you know that in Bloomington there was one of the most successful conference of the learning sciences a couple of years ago. He's also adjunct faculty in the cognitive science program there. His education in higher education started with a Bachelor's of Arts in Liberal Studies, Educational Technology, Telecommunications, and English from San Diego State University, a Master of Science in Psychology from Vanderbilt University, and a PhD also in Psychology in Cognitive Studies, also from Vanderbilt University, Nashville, Tennessee. Many of you know a lot of his publications. I think he will at least speak to one in particular. I particularly like his work on relating the, well, really core psychology concept of motivation to socio-cultural thinking and create the connection to design-based research. And this is, I think, also the core of what we will be discussing today. We agreed in the preparation meeting that Dan will also speak a little bit more on his personal journey through the different sciences, psychology, cognitive science, learning sciences, until he reached that point where he is now. Let me quickly mention a summary of what his research is about. He used design-based research methods and situative theories of cognition to improve learning and instruction. He developed a framework that he calls participatory learning and assessment. And at least it was also part of the paper that we read for today. Dan, we are very much looking forward to hear about your personal journey and your talk about motivation, engagement, and educational gaming in the context of design-based research.
Thank you, Frank, and thanks everyone for coming. So I started my responding to Frank's interest. I was initially trained to measure stuff. I began my studies. I did my PhD with Jim Pellegrino when Jim considered himself a differential psychologist. He was very good at measuring individual differences, and my first publication was in fact in the Journal of Learning and Individual Differences. So I spent the first part of my graduate work getting really good at measuring stuff, learning how to develop good performance assessments, and learning how to measure motivation and interest. And as Jim said it, he felt I did more surveys while I was a graduate student than a lot of people do in their career. But I really grew disgruntled. I found that I was learning lots of what was happening, but that wasn't actionable information. And three people really shaped my trajectory and pointed me in the direction I am today. One was John Bransford pointed out to me that my very careful efforts to use self-report measures of motivation to document the impact of things like Jasper Woodbury were fundamentally flawed. Because that if you do it in an experimental, in a comparison study, such as I did in my dissertation, because of the nature of self-report measures, the people in the implementation group are answering a different question. In other words, the experience that they had is likely to change how they interpret the questions. And that change is sort of unknown and unknowable. So not only did that lead me to question everything I had been finding, it further convinced me that survey-based research, particularly trying to sort of directly inform projects from using surveys, was problematic. Another one was Susan Goldman, who just at one point, she doesn't remember saying this to me, but she just said, "Who cares? Who cares about all this stuff you're finding?" I mean, lots of people do really good theoretical work with Around self-efficacy, self-concept, there's been some fabulous foundational work that's been carried out. But in terms of refining the learning environments, I really didn't, I wasn't able to say very much. I wasn't able to provide much actionable research. The third person who influenced my work a lot was Joyce Moore, who was a student of Jim Greeno's. And while I was at Vanderbilt, she was one who sort of pulled me aside and said, you know, you're really not getting the full picture here on the situativity theory. There's a lot more to it than is represented by the work that's happening. And when I went off and did my postdoctoral fellowship at ETS at the Center for Performance Assessment, I really took Joyce's suggestions to heart. And in an article that is in about the work that I've done with Genscope, a paper that we published in the American Ed Research Journal in 2003 sort of documents how I really came to realize that the sort of so-called sociocultural and situative theories of learning, and particularly Jim Greeno's situative theories and the notion of the dialectic that is outlined in Greeno's work, especially Greeno 1998, really revealed new ways of thinking about assessment and motivation that people hadn't been thinking about. And in particular, it made me realize that if you go really far down the situative sort of rabbit hole, you reach a point where you're able to look back and look at individual achievement and individual understanding, as well as individual motivation, be it the way that people behave or the way that people think and process information. You can treat all of that individual activity as special cases of a higher order situated sociocultural activity. And I felt like that had enormous potential for resolving what I think are two huge problems in education. One is this debate over assessment formats, this sort of long-running struggle over multiple choice versus performance assessment versus portfolio assessment. So in my assessment work, I just treat all assessments now as different points of formality on a continuum, ranging from very informal assessments of people's participation in activity to highly formalized achievement tests that measure change that happens over many years. Well, over the years, I've applied that same logic to the study of motivation. I did my major area paper that was psychologist in 1997. And Sana Yarvala was kind enough to invite me to come to Early in 1999 based on that paper, and that's one of the reasons I'm nicely connected with Early. That was a useful paper. And in that paper, I highlighted something that I had been chasing all of my career as a student, because in 1989, Alan Collins made kind of a passing comment in Collins, Brown, and Newman, Situated Cognition and the Culture of Learning, where he said that the negative effects of competition actually may say more about impoverished learning environments than it says about competition itself. That really struck me a lot, and I tried hard to make sense of that, and I really came to believe it, because I realized that many of the studies where the so-called over-justification effect had been shown, that extrinsic incentives diminish engagement, They were carried out in settings that didn't sort of generalize to the settings that I was interested in. In particular, the thing that really shook me to my core was the recognition that in many of the educational gaming spaces where my colleagues were beginning to get very interested, that the primary form of extrinsic incentive that people were being provided was empowerment in the environment. And that really struck me as a serious problem, to say, how can giving someone power simultaneously disempower them? So that's what sort of sent me on this path that I'm on. I wrote a paper for a book that Sana Yarvala edited on motivation and context in 2000 with Mary McCaslin, who introduced a really helpful notion of co-regulated learning, which is a more sociocultural alternative to self-regulated learning. And then from there, I went even further in 2003 in an invited paper in elementary school journal, where it really outlined the implications of Greenough's notions of engaged participation and advanced engaged participation as an alternative way of thinking about achievement motivation. So the study that I'm going to talk about today does that. Let me stop and see if there are any questions. Okay, and the chat's open and I'm monitoring the chat if you'd like to ask. Okay, so let me do a quick poll again. How many of you are familiar with the video game called Quest Atlantis? Click on the vote button on the bottom and insert your vote, please. Yeah, vote no if you're not familiar. Okay, so that's quite a few not familiars. Good. Okay, well, Quest Atlantis, okay, going from slide one to slide two, and I'm sorry, I didn't number the slides. Quest Atlantis was developed by Sacha Barra with the support of the National Science Foundation. Other work was supported by, I was supported by the MacArthur Foundation for much of the time I did this work. Ellen Jamieson, Steve Zeiger, Adam Grobel, Yujun Kwan, Yunju Kwan were instrumental in the work I'm going to talk about today. And in particular, I have to acknowledge Jake Summers, who is an amazing teacher, who implemented Quest Atlantis, the Taiga environment, with all four of his sixth grade science classes every year from 2005 to 2010. So what I'm going to show you is a slice, one implementation that occurred out of five consecutive ones. This was the fourth of five consecutive implementations. Next slide. Slide three. So there is an article in this book, Assessment and Game-Based Learning. I'm happy to send you copies. I think it's also mounted at Academia, where I lay out this framework that has emerged really across all of my work. I call this participatory assessment, and it really is sort of a very assessment-intensive approach that really takes a very situative view on learning. And the important part is on slide three, you see the first idea is to let context give meaning to conceptual tools. And this was a centerpiece of Quest Atlantis. Sacha Barra did a really good job. There's two articles published in 2007 where he shows how in the very first implementation of QA, the kids really liked the game, but they didn't really dig into the disciplinary content. They didn't engage in what Randy Engel, who's a big influence in my work, calls productive disciplinary engagement. You want productively with the disciplinary knowledge of whatever it is they're doing. And in this case, in Taiga, so move on to slide four, please. Taiga is an ecological sciences curriculum. It's about 13 to 20 hours. It's about eutrophication. We Americans love to teach children about rivers. We know that. That's been brought up many times. I'm not sure why they chose rivers other than eutrophication is a pretty cool cycle, and we have a lot of rivers in the U.S., but yeah, there's River City, which often is confused. River City is a very different curriculum, much more of a socio-constructivist curriculum. Kids go and they enter Taiga. Go to slide five, please. The one with the ranger. So there's Ranger Bartle. He's a rather busy guy. He's a rather stern guy, and he tells them, look, I'm a busy guy. I really need some help. I need you to go figure out why the fish in this river are dying. So the children go into this game and take on the identity of a field ranger, as an apprentice field ranger, helping Ranger Bartle figure out why the fish in the river are dying. They go around and interview all kinds of non-player characters. They take samples of water. They do what are called quests, so these five written quests. And they get water samples, and ultimately, they need to balance the needs of diverse users. This is a good example of Troy Sadler, who was involved in this project early on, has introduced the notion of socio-scientific inquiry. So we're basically trying to get students to see the intersection of human and science, human problems and science. Okay. This is what a quest looks like, slide number five, number six. So one of the amazing things about Quest Atlantis is the amount of writing that it generates. I'm a big fan of writing. I think that writing is the 21st century skill. And I believe strongly that students in all domains, in all activities, should be writing, and they should be held accountable for their writing. That's one of a key principle of Randy Engels, is that not only should students engage in disciplinary discourse, they should be held accountable for learning to walk the walk and talk the talk of the discipline. And so what you really want to see here in this case, as the students are completing this, we have a good idea of the disciplinary knowledge that is expected when a student completes one of these quests. And the quest is submitted for review by the ranger, and during the time of the game, the ranger is inhabited by the teacher. In other words, the teacher plays the ranger. Now, in Jake's class, because he had so many students, this was a pretty big issue. In the end, this created an enormous amount of work for Jake to review these roughly 50-word things to keep students moving through the game. But we knew that that was the locus of a great deal of learning in the game. So what we were trying to do was find ways to get students to turn in to for their initial submissions to be better. On to slide 7, Taiga assessment by level. And I will stop for questions here in a second. So out of all of my prior work, and this is my advice to graduate students, is that, you know, assessment is a huge problem for students. They often really struggle to do high quality assessment. And one of the reasons, in my opinion, is because they're taking a very narrow approach to assessment, typically a tacitly cognitivist approach to assessment. And I think that if you sort of step back and distinguish between sort of really close activity, in this case, this is the content of the quest submissions. In other words, if you look at the students as they write their quest and treat that as an informal assessment, that's a really useful way to think about it's a summative assessment of the activities that led up to the quest, but it's a formative activity of their knowledge of the discipline. Moving out one level, then, is a performance assessment. This is, in my case, a very great, well-defined performance assessment that Ellen Jameson and ecologists developed that asks students to solve similar problems in a somewhat different context. It was also a water ecosystem, but it was a different ecosystem, and so students had to they had to transfer their knowledge of socio-scientific inquiry and of eutrophication and erosion out of the game context and into a different, literally, it was a picture of an ecosystem. Many of my colleagues in assessment, I don't think that formal assessments are particularly useful for giving formative feedback to students. By the time students have completed the assessment, they generally just want to know why they got their grade, and they want to argue for more points and stuff. So, and often when you give students feedback, you often compromise the assessment, I think generally they're really good for evaluating and guiding the refinement of the curriculum. And then finally, at the distal level, you're really asking yourself, is this going to impact achievement on high-stakes tests? Now, and here's also where I diverge from many of my colleagues in the learning sciences. In my opinion, if you want to make claims about impacting achievement, and if you want to see whether or not you're improving over time, a proximal assessment is quite problematic because you're constantly refining and aligning the curriculum to that assessment. So, of course, scores are going up. But you don't know how much of that increase is due to what measurement theorists call construct irrelevant variance. So you really have to have randomly selected items that are aligned to targeted standards that are completely independent of the curriculum, that the teachers never see and that the designers never see. And only use them very carefully in a pre-post design to measure achievement. So, moving on to the next slide, incentives, competition, engagement, and learning. So, let me get a vote here. How many of you are familiar with what is known as the over-justification effect? How many of you, vote yes or no, have you heard of the over-justification effect? Okay, three, okay. So many of you have. So that's where when you give someone an incentive for something that they already enjoy doing it, they will do it less. when that incentive is no longer present. Good, five of you have. It's been documented over and over again. There's in the paper that we sent out, there's two theoretical justifications for the negative consequences of incentives. So there's tons of studies. People are still looking at all of this stuff. I have kind of a problem with a lot of the studies on motivation in gaming. Most of them out there, people do some sort of a self-report, and then they look at some correlation of what people do in the game, and they say that they're related. Well, of course they are, but that's not really very useful. I really believe that design-based methods and efforts to say, well, what are the incentives in the game, and how do we refine those incentives so that they can actually impact disciplinary engagement? So on the bottom of this slide, so I mentioned there in 2003 in my elementary school journal article, I really unpack this argument that from a situative perspective, that incentives are just kind of neutral, and that the first thing you have to do is look and see what they do to engage participation, and only then do you concern yourself with what they do with individuals. In a handbook chapter in the handbook of, oops, sorry, there's a typo there. That's in the handbook of classroom management. And all these papers are on academia.com if you're interested. Did you really want to focus most of your energy on fostering this sort of engaged participation? Look at Randi Engel's work. Look at her guidelines for fostering, getting kids, you know, engaging in disciplinary discourse, using the formalisms of the discipline. Then look and see what your strategies for making that happen do to proximal understanding and to situational motivation. And then after that, look and see at their consequences for the sort of distal achievement and their sort of long-term interest. So much of this is about feedback in the end, right? So do I study assessment? Do I study motivation? Slide 9. I have a paper that's coming out shortly in the British Assessment Journal that did all the Black and Willem stuff, where I'm really coming out hard on this argument that we need to just stop doing studies that prove that, I see some chat here. Okay, I'll come back to that. Thank you, Mr. Gottlieb. So let me just finish up on slide 9 here. Feedback. We just need to stop doing studies that prove that feedback works. There are dozens of them. There are hundreds of them. People go in and they provide formative feedback and they show that people have learned more than feedback. That is a test of educational malpractice, in my opinion. We just need to stop doing that. Instead, we need to recognize that when you remove children from an instructional environment, especially a high-quality instruction environment, to give them sort of assessments and stuff, to give them feedback, well, there's ways to do that. And some of those ways are better than others. So we really should be studying comparing different kinds of feedback. It turns out it's very difficult to do that because of the way your feedback compromises assessments. But it's I think, where we should put our energy. Probably the most important thing of all that I'll show you today is that feedback must be useful and it must be used. A great deal of feedback that gets provided doesn't end up being used or is used in ways that doesn't support learning. All right, that's the intro. Okay, I see I have a question here. Wondering your take on response shift bias and in pre-post design. Might you address that at some point? Yeah, let's come back to that and I'll ask you to explain what you mean. And Frank, yes, this is a challenge for many learning scientists. Yes, I have enraged more than a few. I recently got a review that's characterized my take on situative theory as being very idiosyncratic. Fortunately, for my sake, Jim Greeno seemed to be very much in consistent with what the way I was framing that work. And as far as I'm concerned, he wrote the book. So what we did in Quest Atlantis is, if now you look at slide number 10, in our initial implementations of QA, the learning gains were quite trivial. There's a paper in Ed Researcher that Sasha published a little while ago describing these first round of findings. And we weren't surprised because the students were completing these quests at the time. The research team was giving feedback. The feedback wasn't very good. It was sort of say more, do this. So one of the things we did, one of the things the assessment team did, was develop a pretty sophisticated rubric for teachers to use to score those quests. And what you see there is the things that needed to be present there. And on the right on the box was feedback that the teachers could cut and paste in order to give the feedback. The other thing we did during our design cycle, slide 11, is Ellen Jamieson and Adam Ingram Goebel and I, in a paper that's in the Journal of Science Education and Technology in 2009, we describe how we added this new formative feedback routine, and students were invited when their quest was rejected by their teacher. The teacher said, or the ranger said, "Hey, go talk to the lab technician. He knows a bunch about water quality." And we knew the paper that we published in 2009 showed that had a dramatically positive impact on learning, and I'll show you what that looks like. If you go to slide 12, what you see there in 2006 is the first study with Jake Summers. You can see that in the Taiga version, in blue, you can see a statistically larger gain in their understanding on a sophisticated performance assessment. In red, you see a smaller, non-statistically significant gain in achievement. I'll return to that distinction later, but what you see there is when in 2007, where we introduced the feedback, you see a dramatically larger gain in their performance on that performance assessment task. 1.2 standard deviations, and if you know your standard deviations, you know that's a pretty big gain on a measure that is arguably quite a valid assessment of their understanding. Importantly, you see this thing that I call an echo. You see that our efforts to increase performance on the with the feedback led to this echo on their achievement. And that gain was in fact statistically significant, unlike the previous one. It's about 0.3. Probably some of the very first evidence out there of statistically gains in achievement from an immersive video game on a set of items that were aligned to targeted standards but completely independent of the curriculum. So, the 2009 JSET paper is that the log file analysis showed that most of that increase in learning was made by the relatively small number of students who did actually use the formative feedback. Only one-fifth of the students never actually accessed the formative feedback. They just rewrote it and submitted. One-fifth of the students looked at all 30 screens, and their scores went up dramatically. That begs the question, how do we motivate students to use more of that formative feedback? Well, the obvious question is, can we use incentives? Quest Atlantis had built into it a fairly sophisticated incentive system. However, it didn't really work at the level of the individual games. So in fact, what we did in this study is we stripped out all of those incentives. Before I talk about that, though, I want to talk about some of the challenges of studying incentives in immersive context. This is slide 13. So if you dig into Greeno's work, you'll see this notion of an aggregative reconciliation between individual and social activity. I'm not going to go too far down this path, but to say that most studies of motivation and assessment embrace this aggregative reconciliation. They treat the social activity as an aggregation of what individuals think and do. So you have Bandura's notion of collective self-efficacy or collective efficacy. It's not an oxymoron. He really does think that what the collective does is an aggregation of what the individuals do. My work embraces this very different model, this dialectical reconciliation, where I start with the assumption that the social context and the values that reside in the social context are primary, and the stuff that people have within their hearts and minds are secondary representations of that. Theoretically, that's what I'm doing. But it's a challenge to embed sort of the kind of quasi-experimental studies that people need to be convinced of this in ongoing design research. This is a big challenge. So the last thing I want to say is that the incentives in this that we built into this game were typical of commercial games. They have consequences, right? If you succeed at this, you will get a hat, you will get a badge, we will unlock some powers for you. We did this much more in the next study the next year, but I'm going to focus on it in this year. It's just a big, if any point you take away from my talk, it's recognizing that it seems pretty illogical to think that an incentive that gives somebody power is going to simultaneously disempower them. All right, let me stop and see if there are, okay, one brief example of a targeted standard independent of the curriculum. Thanks. That's a great question. In the very first implementation of QA, Sasha had identified 10 standards that he felt he was going to impact. And I said, dude, that is too many standards. You're not going to do that. And sure enough, he didn't. So we cut it down to 4. So we found the 4 standards, the 4 existing educational standards that were most consistent with Quest Atlantis. Then we went off and we searched release state tests for items that clearly were aligned to those standards. And we had a pool of those items. Every year we drew at random to keep them from being compromised. We drew a new set of assessments from those pools. And then we used a counterbalance pre-post design with them. Frank, you asked about collective efficacy. That is Bandura's notion. If you look it up, Bandura late in his life focused a lot on this. Sort of his solution to global issues was in terms of collective efficacy. And it is, he says literally that there is no disembodied group mind. And that's a good example of what I mean and what Jim Greeno means when he says an aggregative reconciliation of the individual and the social. Behaviorists do the same thing. They have this notion of collective contingencies. In the piece of paper that was sent around for my talk, there's a link, or if you just Google sociocultural theories of motivation, there's a pretty nice short dictionary entry out on the web that that explains some of that a little more. Okay. Let me ask this question then. Let's get a little more interaction here. Let's use your, go to the vote, please, and say, before this talk started, use the emoticon. What is your general response to the use of extrinsic incentives to support learning? Right, so if you're all right with them, give me a happy face. If you're not, give me a sad face. And if you're uncertain or you're curious, give me a Fulia, we're waiting for you. Okay, LMU? Okay, they're disappearing. They don't stay on long. Okay, good. Nice mixed group. Okay. That was fun. So, I'm looking at the time, 1:41. Okay, that's about right. Okay, so here's how what I did. So go to slide 15, please. So in the motivation studies, I try to capture engagement at these same levels. So close engagement was deemed as intentionality during the Quest 2 formative feedback. Like, so were they really trying to improve their Quest submissions? Were they just phoning it in? Were they just saying whatever they felt they needed to do to get the ranger to approve it and move on? Were they really trying to use disciplinary formalisms in appropriate ways? So the measure in this case is the appropriate use of disciplinary formalisms. Did they use the term eutrophication And did they use that term correctly when they were writing their quest? And we focused on quest 2 because it was a really important part of this learning environment. Then at the proximal level, or what I would call that first level, is activity oriented. The orientation of the engagement is to the actual activity. At the proximal level is what I call a curriculum oriented measure. You're really asking them about their engagement as it orients to the broader curriculum. And so in this case, we asked them about their intrinsic motivation during Quest 2. This was a self-reported, very familiar self-report measure that I'll show you during Quest 2. And then finally, at the distal level is sort of their longer term, their dispositions. And in this case, what was the impact of the playing the game on their self-reported interest in solving different kinds of problems of the sort that they're studying? In other words, do we see a long-term change in their interest in doing this that would predict that they would choose to engage in this in the future? If you go to, I will show you the slide. Slide 16 is the motivational survey, right? So this is pretty familiar stuff. We know how to do this. It's not hard. The reliabilities were fine. I deleted the effort. I was trying to insert. Anyways, so you guys are familiar with these. Apologies for the confusion there. And then if you go to slide 17, you can see the motivational survey. Go back to slide 16 first. Right, so this is somebody completes Quest 2, submits it. When Quest 2 is accepted, they're automatically given this survey and asked to complete this survey. In contrast, on slide 17, as part of the pretest and post-test of achievement, we had them fill out a survey that asked them about their personal interest in solving problems about water quality, in solving problems about complex science, and in solving problems about controversial science. So there you see the stem and the sample item for each of these. And these have been pilot tested pretty extensively. They work pretty well. And again, this stuff's not hard to measure. So if you go on to 2008 incentive study results. So overall, here's what we got. Oh, wow. I'm sorry. I skipped a bit here. My sincere apologies. Go to slide 14, please. I see a chat. Yeah, someone's asking about the self-report measures of interest. Well, we're asking them in the materials they're using. So I can't imagine using someone else's measure for that. And frankly, it doesn't really matter. It enrages some of my colleagues, but I sort of just use the term self-fill in the blank. I mean, a Likert scale item compresses everything into this relativistic thing. It's just, you know, for the kinds of things I'm doing, in my experience, in my opinion, it doesn't really make that much difference. You want to run factor analysis to make sure you're getting separate factors. You want to make sure you have internal consistency. But in this case, I'm really asking them about how interested did you feel in the thing you were just doing? And the other measures were, how interested are you in these topics that we're looking at? So here's what we did in this study. We manipulated public recognition and questing. So we matched the classes together very carefully. And in two of the classes, we removed any incentives. And we replaced all the information about incentives with information that was consistent with Lepper and Malone. Basically, you must be really curious. Let's really help the fish. You really want to help. So the fantasy, the curiosity, we really played those things up as much as we could. And that is called the non-public recognition condition. In the public recognition condition, whenever your quest was accepted, you were given a badge to put on your avatar. And that avatar could say either wise, developing expert or wise. And the students not only put the the badge on their avatar, but they also were able to move their avatar across the leaderboard. You can see the photo there in the lower right. So everybody knew where everybody else in the game was. And we knew that this took, we knew that the students spent a lot of time talking in front of the leaderboard. What did you do to get wise? So we knew that there were definitely some the kinds of desirable positive consequences that we believe can come with good incentive practices. However, we did not try to deliberately foster that, which I think is a very rich area to study, but we felt that that was a potential confound. So that just occurred. We observed that happening, but we did not encourage it. So what did we find? I'm going to dive right into the results. Please go to slide number 19. What you're looking at on slide 19, called close engagement and learning, and notice it's called close engagement and learning. At the close level, at this sort of situated level, the distinction between engagement and learning breaks down. They're sort of seen as more or less one and the same, and this is what I mean by disciplinary engagement. I think that anybody who's engaging, in this case, you can see along the bottom algae, dissolved oxygen, erosion, eutrophication. What you're seeing there is the number of times, the average number of times that they were enlisted in this particular population. Now, this is a subset of them. This is 20 in 20 out of the 50 in each group. What you see is that the public recognition group enlisted more of those formalisms than the non-public recognition group. But the real question is, did they enlist them more accurately? Right? Because if the students are just saying stuff to get the incentive, that would confirm the negative findings. So Michael did another coding where he went through with the same 20 students and said, but were they enlisting them more accurately? And what you see there is that generally they were. Now, we have struggled with these results. We've actually scored the entire set of students. The results are similar, but we have not been able to get it. This paper was rejected once because they did not feel that this was an adequate methodology. It's been a very frustrating stretch trying to get this work published. So, but for my money, that suggested to me, and as a design researcher, that, that's pretty good. There certainly isn't anything bad going on. Those results were rejected when we submitted this paper to Cognition and Instruction. So the next set of results, if you go to slide number 21, these are the learning gains. Now I want to take a few minutes and talk about this. What you see there is the gain in blue. Right, so there's the highlight of the two 2008 conditions. That gain was statistically significant at a 0.02 level. However, the gain in red, the difference between the two red columns, which is this distal achievement, did not achieve statistical significance. Now, the paper that I sent around, Michael, reflecting the struggle that we've had, I just said, we've just got to get this thing submitted. You be first author. Let's get this thing published. And in response to the criticism of the reviewers and these very skeptical reviewers who seem to inhabit all the journals that have anything to do with technology, I argued in the paper that was published in Journal of Learning Sciences in 2012 with the Genscope work, that even though that gain in red, the difference between the with incentive and without incentive, in other words, the difference between a 0.8 and a 0.1 standard deviation gain, Because that's an echo of that larger gain, I'm able to report it. I believe that it's very unlikely, even though there's only a 1 in 13 chance that that gain would have occurred if all other things were equal. All other things are not equal. In my opinion, the fact that that gain in achievement is an echo of the gain in understanding in blue, and that those echoes were almost identical in the two groups and the two classes, in other words, both conditions improved about the same amount, I believe that I should be able to claim that as a finding. Michael has elected not to leave it out. We're still negotiating. I wonder what you think. Do you believe that the advantage, so click on your votes and tell me if you think that the gain in achievement was caused by the intervention. In other words, can we say that the incentive led to enhanced achievement in those 50 students? Cast your vote. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Fulia. Martin, still on the fence. Anybody else? Well, that's interesting. Five abstains. Okay, let's go ahead and stop for questions now. I'd love to hear from people. I'd love to hear from Martin or Fulia. Fulia, why do you why don't you get in the queue and tell me why you think that that's acceptable?
Sorry, can you hear me? I all the time think that intervention is beneficial for education, so that's why I said yes. I thought it benefit. Short answer, but that's why I voted that.
Does anyone else want to weigh in? Raise your hand if you do. Okay, I'll move along then. So, go to slide 22, please. Here you see the self-report interest of what I call proximal engagement or motivational experience. Slight non-significant advantages, I'll clear the votes, slight non-significant advantages for all of these outcomes. And by the way, Michael is transiting right now, which is why he was unable to join us, but he is in Germany. He's on holiday. So all of them favor the incentive group slightly. It's my opinion that that should be reported. It's not, I don't think it's fair to say that there was no difference, as the current manuscript says. In fact, I think you have to say there was a difference. All those different favored the, in this case, what we've called the public recognition group. I wonder whether people think we should just go with what's currently in the manuscript and just say there was no difference. So could you vote on that, please? In other words, should we leave it out, or should we report it and point out that it's in the direction favoring incentives, but it wasn't significant? I see some new chat. Okay. Frank, you want to weigh in on your opinion on this?
Well, I think your theory, if you have a hypothesis leading in that direction, and you have a very small effect size, then the reason for not being able to show significant results is that the power of the study might have been too low. And so therefore, my first, this is a purely method-related answer, but I would rather think of increasing the power. If you have an idea, a theory, and an expectation for this direction, and the direction really shows in your descriptive results, but the effect is not significant, then maybe it's just that the effect is too small to be shown with that number of participants. And therefore, you could go two ways, or at least I would recommend two ways. One is to increase the power to have more participants, but I think the even better way is what you seem to suggest, that you interpret the differences. They are there descriptively. They are not significant, but that does not mean they are not existing, because the power is quite low. So a critical reviewer might say, well, the results are inconclusive because the power is too low. But from my perspective, given that study, and I found that really very good, I would go on interpreting these effects and speaking about, asking for studies, investigating that with more power. But from the theory perspective, I think it's good to interpret that.
Yeah, well, I wasn't really testing a hypothesis here. What I was trying to say is that I don't think incentives are bad. I guess that's a hypothesis, but I guess what I'm saying is, for my money, this should be enough for other people who might want to use these kinds of incentives to say, oh, okay, I'll give it a try. I don't think they're bad. In fact, if anything, they're good. So I don't think that I would, for instance, this was a lot of work to do this study. I mean, I certainly wouldn't go out and do it. I mean, 50 per group is a pretty powerful study. I agree with Dan. That's a very good point. So the incentive, so the question is, did we get any positive consequences? Yes, we got this very clear positive consequence on the proximal understanding and achievement, but we don't appear to have the negative consequences that we worry about. Let's take a look at the distal achievement measures. Go to slide 23. A slight increase, right? That's a very small effect. It's the F is less than 1, but just barely. You know, there's a 50% chance of this occurring given the wide variance. But the point is that there's a tiny interaction in favor of increasing interest in the public incentive group. And we see the exact same pattern across the other three measures going on to slide 24 and on to slide 25. So in conclusion, going to slide 26, there's a slight positive consequence. I believe that there's a slightly positive consequence on engagement, disciplinary engagement, cognitive engagement, and interest. And I believe that there's a significant positive impact on proximal understanding and distal achievement, because I believe that even though there's only a 1 in 13 probability or 0.07 on the achievement outcome, I believe that that's very unlikely to have occurred by chance given that that is a very precise echo of the statistically significant gain in achievement. So as a design researcher, I was perfectly comfortable incorporating that feature into my curriculum and moving forward without fear of the negative consequences. I think this supports the argument that Collins made, that I've been making, that competition is okay as long as there's feedback and opportunities to improve, and that I'll skip that next point. So with that, I want to open this up to questions. So we've got some good ones here. Dan, let me turn the mic over to you. Let me ask for one more vote. I'm going to clear that vote. These are tiny. the gains, the interest on slide 23, 24, and 25. Those are tiny gains, but again, it seems to me that we should report them and say, if anything is happening from the incentives, it's a favorable outcome. And there's no indication of a negative outcome. Do people think, click on yes, if you think that I should tell Michael, insist that we need to include these in this paper. Even though it's already been accepted, that's kind of a problem. One, two. Okay. Good. All right, we're gonna get right on that then, thank you. Let me come back to the chat. Let's open things up now for, we have plenty of time for questions and discussion. I'm gonna look at Dan's question here. The main issue with this measure might be that the engagement is a result of the immersion in the game rather than the nature of the incentive, or at least it seems the incentive does not top the gaming in terms of engagement. Yeah, that's really, really true. Dan, do you want to come on and talk? You want to raise your, click on the hand and raise your hand? Doesn't have a mic. Okay, sorry. Okay. So, I guess I'll just blather on about that point and maybe hope that other people will join in and say something about it. Yeah, those are fairly sensitive. They're reliable measures. Those are trusted measures. I think the point is just the engagement, the incentives were an overlay. The next year, in Yunju Kwan's dissertation, which he's still trying to analyze, we actually changed the incentive that you also got a hat and a backpack, and that backpack unlocked special powers. Now that created an enormous problem. And that is, if you really do give incentives that give power, you've introduced a huge confound in the game, and so you can no longer directly compare the learning outcomes. I just don't know what to do about that, other than to say, screw it. Let's just do it. Let's give those incentives, even though we know that we can no longer directly compare the learning outcomes, because the person who got the incentive, you've given them special powers that they can use to succeed in the game. Okay, and then OG, here's my question about shift response bias. I think these are pre and post measures of interest. I'm struggling with this in my, why don't you?
Oh, sorry, OG, it's your turn. I come back with my question later.
Hi, so this is what I was thinking about with these measures of interest, and it may or may not relate, but I'll throw it out there. I'm trying to understand if these are pre and post measures. I've been reading about the phenomenon of the response shift bias, and that the experience of, say, the game, in the case of the research that I've been reading, it's about outdoor experience. I'm doing outdoor gaming, a digital gaming outdoors, that experience actually shifts the player's understanding or their own scale of how they respond to a post test on interest, so that the experience shifts that. And I'm looking at trying to measures to ameliorate that, and I'm wondering whether that's a part of this or whether you face that, because I'm finding this as an issue in my own data collection actually.
That's awesome, Owen. I have not heard the term response shift bias, but that seems like exactly what John Bransford warned me about. I feel pretty okay with the fact that it seems very unlikely to me that the introduction of the incentive introduced a response shift. We thought about that long and hard and said, is there anything about that incentive that would change what this thing means? I don't think so, but again, you know, my point is I focus directly on engaged participation and only secondarily at these measures anyways. So, you know, this these results are really, in some respects, more for other people than they are for me, because I sort of theoretically believe that, you know, you really should be focusing your time and energy on making sure that your incentives foster productive engagement. The public and private condition. Yeah, thanks, Frank. That's a good question. In the public condition, everyone in the game knew which quest the other people had completed, and whether they had got, and what level they had completed it at. So they were literally moving a paper version of their avatar on a board so that all of the students knew, as is the case in many commercial video games. On slide number 14, on many commercial video games, you know the status and the success of your partners. Then their avatar had a badge on it that was colored, that indicated what level they had completed their most recent quest. And so there was none of that in the private recognition condition, and all of the text that referenced the badges and stuff was simply replaced with an encouragement and highlighting the curiosity. Leper and Malone, basically. I can give another example of this, if you like. Let me see. I can post a URL, correct? Give me one second, please. So I just finished up a pretty cool project. Oh, I have another poll. How many of you have heard of open digital badges? And when I say that, know what I mean when I say open digital badges. Or did so before you read the paper that I sent around? I sent a URL. I don't know if you can see it. Oh, that's weird. Yes, Frank, private is no incentive. There was no badges, and they also did not know where the other students were in the game.
Okay, thanks. Sorry. LMU was actually Julia and Fabian and Freitas, so they were not my questions, although they were still good. I had a different question, if I may, but you want to speak to the website, I guess. I will come back to with my question later on then.
Okay, so I put up a post. So open digital badges are something I'm very involved in. It's this notion of a web-enabled micro-credential. They're very different than grades, and they're very different than transcripts. We've got a big movement here advancing them. It's going very well. I've just finished a study of 30 projects that were funded to issue digital badges, varied projects over the past 2 years. And it looks like I'm going to be kicking off another study implementing digital, helping the edX platform and other online learning environments on a higher ed issue digital badges. So let's see, highlighting curiosity. So let me use, Martin, let me use your example. So highlighting curiosity as an incentive. So that's one of the kinds of things that people were doing in these environments with digital badges, where I can think of a couple of the projects we studied where they had a badge that you could earn by demonstrating your curiosity in some sort of mostly informal learning environment. Let me think of an example. Well, the example I use in my book, I just finished a course, a big open online course on educational assessment, and the link in there describes the badges that we issued in that course. And if you completed the assignments and your classmates, at least one of your classmates, endorsed your assignments as being complete, and you took the exam in my open course, if you completed the, let's say, the four assignments in assessment practices, you earned a digital badge. And that badge, if you wanted it to, could contain links to all of your work. It and if you had earned more promotions from your classmates for being exemplary, for having done exemplary work, the version of that badge you got was automatically said leader on it. And when you issued that badge to yourself, you could choose, if by clicking a button, to actually include what your peers said about you that was exemplary. And then when you shared that badge, if you put it, if you sent it out to Facebook, for example, all of your peers would see the image on the badge, and when they clicked on that badge, they would see what you had done to earn that badge. They would see, if you had chosen to, they could see the assignments that you completed, and they could see what your classmates said about you that was exemplary. So I have a team, we're actually studying the motivational practices. Kat Schenke and Katerina Schenke and Kathy Tran at UC Irvine are looking very carefully at the motivational principles, and quite a few people, Jan Plas at NYU, a whole bunch of people are looking at the motivational consequences. Jan actually has a very nice study from the Gates Foundation to look at motivational consequences of digital badges.
Okay, now I try my question. I would like to come back to the question that you raised earlier then with respect to these slight improvements on the one hand side that were non-significant. I think as the paper is now, if I reconsidered also my reading, and I think it's well put to say there is at least no negative effect, and given that you have even a slight positive one, well, normally have problems creating a proof that things are identical. This is not possible, basically. But if you don't have a negative effect, but even have a slight positive effect, you can say, well, there is no negative effect in that study. And I think this is already what a main message could be. Highlighting that in a rich learning environment, these negative effects of external rewards are not happening. I think that's a big statement, and you have some evidence for that. That's great already. I think one thing that always comes to my mind when I look at this paper, I think that there is much more in it with respect to the engagement aspect. So an engaged disciplinary discourse, as I understood it, as an alternative measure, more or less, to self-reports on motivation. I think in the future, the data could be analyzed in a way that you show how low the correlation is, or I assume it's low, between this engagement and the self-reported motivation measure. And moreover, I think a great thing would be a moderator analysis with the self-reported motivation measure and the learning outcomes on the one hand side, so from the experimental conditions via motivation, self-reported, to the conceptual gains or knowledge gains, and alternatively testing the model with the engagement as the moderator. And I think this would be, well, at least from my understanding, I'm not too deep in that discussion, but I think that would be a revolutionary message to say, well, these self-reported motivation measures, they are moderating these learning outcomes a bit, but we have a much more powerful explanatory variable with this discourse-related engagement.
Yeah, that's that's basically the message I've been trying to get out for quite some time, but I find that maybe I'm not saying it right or whatever, but because we just get so much pushback from editors, from reviewers, that, you know, I just told Michael, just you lead this thing, let's just get this thing published. I just need to get these results published. They're literally 6 years old. So we're going to circle back and see what we think. I'll meet with him after this. I see an interesting couple of interesting comments here. Annalise, would you like to come on and say a little more about fear of failure? Looks like she walked away from her camera, though. I guess I'll talk about fear of failure. To me, fear of failure is a consequence of formal assessment. And that's one of the reasons why I think that assessments should be used very sparingly. If we go back up to my model of participatory assessment, so if everybody would go back up to slide number 3. So the prerequisite in my approach, which has now been used in quite a few different... Okay, hi Annalise, I'm back talking to you. Do you want to come on? Do you want to say a bit more about your concerns?
Hello. Yes, indeed. When you were talking about the external rewards you are using in the books, I was thinking, what about people who have like a kind of fear of failure, and what about the pressure? I think it's when you work with these rewards, it's more that there is more pressure for students. Can you say something about this, or do you investigate also this possible social effect? Thank you.
That's a great question, Annalise. Yes, we think about that a lot. You know, first and foremost, I'm concerned with what the incentives do for participation in discourse. So one of my studies from last summer that we're looking at now showed that when we introduced these sort of badges, these very informal, we called them stamps at the time, that both the number and the disciplinary quality of the comments actually increased. So my biggest concern is that the introduction of the incentive undermines participation in discourse. Secondarily, yes, so my concern with fear of failure is not that people experience fear of failure, because I think fear of failure is just a common everyday thing that people, if you have an authentic, challenging learning environment, people are going to experience that. The important thing is, when people experience that, does it lead them to engage more deeply, or does it lead them to disengage? If it leads them to disengage, then you've got a big problem. So this model of mine, the so-called participatory assessment thing that I've been pushing now, is that on slide 2. And I have quite a few papers now outlining this sort of model. That game-based one reframes all of the QA stuff in this model, even though this model emerged partway about the same, about 2008, 2009. So first and foremost, you know, what you want to do is frame your learning environment so that students that you focus on, actually I've revised this some sense, that you focus on what I'm calling contextual and consequential knowledge. What are the aspects of the environment that take on meaning in the particular context and that have consequences for someone's activities in the real world? First and foremost, do that, and then all the conceptual and factual and procedural knowledge will come along for free because students engage so naturally in contextual and consequential knowledge and discourse around those things. Once you've done that, then you want to reward students for engaging in that. You want to give somebody an opportunity to say, wow, your example of that really helped me appreciate what that means in my setting because it's similar to your setting. So your explanation of why portfolio assessment is impossible to do in mathematics helped me realize why I can't do portfolio assessment in my algebra class, but I really appreciated looking to see how the English teachers were already doing portfolio assessment. That's what I mean by consequential and contextual knowledge. You should find effective ways to reward students for engaging in that. Then my next principle in my model has to do with the artifacts themselves. Never grade them, ever. Have students reflect on what they will do differently because of this activity, and whether their context for learning this activity was appropriate. And if you have to, grade those. And only once you've done those things do you come in and actually assess what somebody understands. But you use that assessment primarily to evaluate the ecosystem that you have in place rather than evaluating individual learners. You only give them, make them worth enough points to motivate students to complete them. And then finally, after you've done all that, very discreetly measure achievement to see whether you're doing better this year than you did last year. But certainly don't expose the teachers or anyone to those assessments. Really, really background any achievement measures. And that's this model that I call participatory learning and assessment. And if the National Science Foundation shines nicely upon me, I'll have even bigger projects. But right now we've used this model to take over the English department of a high school that my university runs. And that's been very successful. We've used it in my online courses. So we've got about five or six situations now where we've used this. And it seems to be delivering pretty high gains in understanding and achievement, but really, really significant amounts of disciplinary engagement. And that's where most of my work is going in the future. And that's my talk. Any questions, suggestions, concerns? Thank you, Annalise.
So if there are no other questions, I would like to raise one question that we ask all our presenters. If you could somehow relate your work to the broader context of the learning sciences. You mentioned a couple of things. I think your work is great in that way that it links, you have measures of motivation, more traditional ones, but you link it in the same study with more discourse and activity-related measures, and I think that's great. But maybe you can speak to that point. So, how do you think your work is important for the learning sciences, and where are differences to, well, let's say, mainstream learning sciences work?
Well, that's a great question. My work, you know, there are some people who find my work a little peculiar because, as Dan Schwartz said to me, it's like you want to have your cake and eat it too. And that's true. I want deep disciplinary engagement, but I believe in these other outcomes. I think that we should leave people with long-term interest, and we know how to measure these things. I believe that we should foster deep disciplinary engagement first and foremost. I want somebody to for a little while when they're in my learning environment to try on the identities and try out the discourses of experts in the domain. And I think of that very much in terms of this notion of legitimate peripheral participation. So I think that what I'm doing in my work is taking the situative theories that for many of us in the learning sciences, my program in particular is a very, very strongly orientation in sociocultural theory. The seminar that I'm teaching this semester, the doctoral seminar, is on situativity. It's not quite so much with Sasha Barab and Melissa Grosolfi, who was a Greeno student departing, but we're known for having a very strongly situative and at least sociocultural orientation. So I kind of cross boundaries in a way, which I think is what the learning sciences is the embodiment of. It allows, the motivation people don't quite own me. The assessment people think my stuff is a little interesting, but they don't see me as an assessment person. So to me, the learning sciences is the home for this kind of interdisciplinary work. I think that I've come up with some pretty, in 15 years, I think I've got some ideas and some evidence that that we can address this sort of just crushing, pointless debate over extrinsic incentives and this pointless debate over different assessment formats. They serve different functions. And so the learning sciences is a place where that kind of interdisciplinary work should be supported, and in particular, where design-based research should happen. I know that from my visits to Europe and my conferences that DVR has been taken up in a lot of different ways, particularly in Europe. I really like Paul Cobb's vision of DVR, and I think that's very much the way I think about things. And so I think that this provide is a way of generating the kind of empirical evidence that people like Rich Shavelson and others who have very fiercely critiqued design research for not delivering generalizable results. I just think you have to do it carefully, and you have to do refinements over time. And then, you know, so my big advice to students is don't rush out and measure right away. Students get themselves in a lot of trouble because they measure things that aren't there yet. And instead, focus on more informal participatory outcomes and make sure those are happening before you go in and try to measure something that might not be there and that you can't do anything about. Questions? Annalise uses SDT theory, self-determination theory, which is one of the major perspectives. I really like DC and Ryan's work. And in fact, I should have a pretty nice piece that we're just finishing up for the Learning Sciences Conference, where we're looking, where we're applying various individual and social theories of motivation to the digital badges, and that is what Kat Schenke at UC Irvine is focusing on. Okay, it's 2:30. I've got to get back to my panel review.
Okay, Dan, thanks for taking the time. Thank you very much for that very interactive, highly interesting webinar. For me, personally, I could say, well, maybe the others would also share a quick reflection before you have to run. I think your distinct position on this undermining effect of extrinsic rewards were really interesting to me. And even more interesting is your approach to measure engagement as an alternative measure for motivation. That is really something that we will also consider in our work, of course. So maybe we have a quick round of reflections and then bye-bye, and I wish you every success with this review panel there.
Yeah, goodbye from Munich, and thank you for the interesting webinar. Are you?
Oh yeah, and thanks for this perspective on the moderating effect of those game designs on the effects of external rewards on engagement and motivation.
Yeah, it was, I think, very stimulating a discussion among us.
Yeah.
I think we will continue a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Yeah, thank you for the new insights about looking at motivation, but also I will remember that we have to look for that we know that feedback works, but we have to look for reasons why it works and why the students use it and stuff like that. That's the point I really will remember. Thank you.
Thank you for the webinar. The nexus of everything you're bringing together in terms of engagement, motivation, DVR, the types of ideas around measurement, it's all really helpful. Like I wrote in chat, I'm going to teach differently, I think, about notions of external motivation. And I think you have this nexus of really fascinating stuff going on. So thank you.
Okay, we close this webinar. Thanks again, everyone, for participating, contributing, and thanks, Dan, for presenting and discussing the work with us. Bye.